This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at Zen Mountain Monastery. Hojin Sensei is a resident teacher at the monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Preface. The Zen Mirror of Tokeji. This is about the 13th century in Japan, and it's from a collection called The Hidden Lamp, stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. The convent at Tokeji had a great mirror. The founding abbess, Kakuzan Shido, would meditate before it in order to see into her own nature. Later, generations of nuns would practice zazen in front of the mirror, concentrating on the question, where is a single feeling, a single thought, in the mirror image in which I gaze? Each abbess of Tokeji wrote a verse in response to the mirror practice. The following verse was composed by the fifth abbess, Princess Yodo. Heart unclouded, heart clouded, standing or falling, it is still the same body. An additional pointer, Master Dogen's face washing verse, Senmon. Holding the toothbrush, may all living beings attain the true Dharma and be naturally pure and clean. Brushing the teeth in the morning, I vow with all beings to care for the eye teeth that bite through all afflictions. Rinsing the mouth, may all living beings approach the pure Dharma gate and accomplish liberation. Washing the face, I vow with all beings to attain the pure Dharma gate and be forever undefiled. Where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image at which I gaze? So we just are finishing a retreat called Face to Face. Thank you to all the participants who faced so very directly. A courageous group asking, what are we facing? What is a face? What do you see when you look in the mirror? Are you there? What? And as I was preparing for the retreat, I got one big sheet for everyone, and it was called About Face. So on this big sheet, everyone could have a place to put anything on it about face. What you're facing, taking an about face. And so I thought, well, let me get started. I had the room to myself, it was all set up. So I put the paper on the floor and I thought, oh, I'll do a self-portrait looking in the mirror down. And I don't know if you've ever done that, many of you may not have, but everything goes with gravity. So I'm looking at it, and I haven't done this for a while in that particular way. And I was like, the first thing I wrote on about face was, OMG. I was like, oh my God. Like, because I hadn't really seen the changes and just like what, you know, so at first my mind was just like rattling away, like, Jesus God Almighty, you know, like just like, you know, the lines and the sags and just like this, and I was just like, okay, stay with it, and, you know. So I did an about face, and I just watched what came up. Sometimes I wrote down, you know, what I was thinking about myself. And so that's where we started. That was the starting point. This exquisite, magical display we call our body, ourself. What is it? So, of course, face does not always mean the physical part of the body. In another way, it's the surface of the mind's mirror, which is also being attended to, seeing or cleaning our body, the directness with our embodiment, and what Dogen's teaching as a sacred awakened activity. And in his writings, the face includes the whole outer surface of the head, but perhaps most importantly, the mouth, the teeth, and the tongue. And so when I was first introduced to the Shobo Genzo, he's a 13th century master, and Shobo Genzo is a collection of his most profound spiritual writings. I went to the a table of contents, and I saw washing the face, using the toilet, brushing your teeth, taking a bath, and the other ones seemed a little far out. So I thought, okay, what's he got to say on washing the face? I was glad to see that there was something about the body, that he was actually attending to our embodiment in detail about how we deal with our body. And, you know, part of me was like, is this like, who is he? And what is he? Is he Mr. Manners? I mean, like, what are these? What's so profound? Don't I know how to do this? What could he say that is like one of the thickest chapters in his Shobo Genzo is washing the face. And it's a talk that he gave 3 times, more than any other talks. So later, this got my attention. I've been working on this for a while. For liberation, Buddha speaks, it's for every body. Every body, every kind of body, every body can be liberated from the suffering, from the ideas, from the constructs, whole body and mind and heart as one reality, that it's not a head kind of thing. And I always felt very strongly, I can't meditate without my body. It's not a head kind of thing. I never felt that. I always felt like there was something below here that had to come along. Some of us, perhaps it's just from here up, and we just meditate with our head. Right? We walk with our head too. But I need this body with all that it's encountered to experience my heart and mind directly. And most of us will not transcend this until death, if we do. And if our body can stand the arising and cessation of pain and suffering, there's no need to transcend it. We need to understand the parts of ourselves that we don't want to know. And that was kind of what the retreat was about. Or am I, okay, do I not want to know? Looking down. Or do I want to know? Do I want to invite myself into every crevice, explore what's happened on this terrain, just see it for what it is? We need to understand the parts that society tells us we should have shame about, which came up a lot in our retreat as we were looking at our face. And how many changes do people make because of that pressure of what's naturally happening? We don't do a lift on a tree, you know, or blow up its branches to make it look different. It's just something to consider. What has creased our face? What increases our lines? And to learn about our context, learn through this, live through into what is true. And to also know we don't have to know all the answers. I don't have to know what is happening. Just the yes. It's true. It's true. No one can tell us what to do and how to live or touch it. But we don't get to be liberated until we're a surveyor of our own face, of our own life and what we're facing. So when we ask this question, where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image in which I gaze? We enter the purpose of our lives. Who are we as living beings? We enter a very mysterious, deep abyss in which we encounter the whole being. Our journey we enter is as vast as space, moving and falling through the sky. And sometimes the sky is cloudy, and sometimes there's not a cloud in the sky. What are these clouds? How do they go away? Sometimes we walk upon this earth, we stumble, we trip, we fall. What makes us stand? What makes us fall? What makes us stand and fall? So looking into the mirror can seem easy, but being honest with what we see might be quite shocking, difficult even, and what we make of it, even more puzzling. And as I, part of the work was to not look, just keep looking at yourself and not look at the paper. So you're just following all those lines very intimately. So it requires an extreme slowing down because there's so many details, so many rivulets, so different. So to not take the broad stroke, but to really slow down and look and see how it actually goes. So we were always like, slow down, slow down. Don't rush. Enjoy. Enjoy just where you are. Don't get ahead, because the mind, if you're on a line, the mind will go, finish it with what we know. So this was like, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. All along, just staying with, I don't know, I don't really know. And the curiosity, whoa, wow, whoa, deeper, up, down, not just, this is my chin, right? And as I looked long and straight, I saw my mother, I saw my father, my ancestors, some coarse little rat hairs coming out of moles, which weren't there before, like really coarse. I could have painted with them, actually. I could have done some calligraphy with them. That's new. Little silver casts on my temples, where my hair was starting to sprout. And I was like, what do I make of an image of an old lady or an old person? And so I began to just look at that on transportation, on the plane. Like, do I say that's an old person? Why do I say that? What makes it old? What is old? What does old look like? And sometimes there were times this week when I was preparing where I'd look in the mirror and just, I'd start weeping at this potato. just changing and sprouting and deeply, especially when you do the eyes, you know, looking into your own eyes and seeing and discovering what you've been through, your history, and how it's there, how you can see it and the marks that it makes in your face. A reminder that my death is coming close, if it's that natural progression, the ash and the dirt stage coming up for real, the tilt in my eyes, the lines of joy and wonder and hurt. And then there's the ability for the spaciousness to just see. Not just look, but actually see. Just see directly. See with the unconditioned eye, no comment. Just facing the mirror to do just this. Washing the face, I vow with all beings to attain the pure Dharma gate and be forever undefiled. So when I first came here into practice, I really didn't know what a Dharma was. Many of you may feel like that today. I heard it a lot, like Dharma, Dharma, Dharma. It was written, it was said, and I was like, what's this Dharma thing? And it was used in many different circumstances, so it was even more confusing. And now you look it up in the dictionary, and it still doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because there's so many different meanings. But then I looked at its roots again, from Sanskrit, which I love to do, and the DHR that it starts off with is to sustain, or to uphold, or to support. And I thought, that's a nice entry. It's got something to do with support, upholding, sustaining. So Dharma supports us, sustains us. And then it went further to say, that which holds or supports us, it said that very Dharma is empty. There is nothing to hold on to. Here's something that sustains us and supports us, but that very thing is empty. What does that mean? And also, what a wonderful freedom, if that's so. A little scary. Supports, but it's not a thing. So looking at Dogen's teachings, particularly in a place where these were offered, where black robes are worn every day, monastics, and very precise, I mean, precise, you've got to read this. Instructions are given about everything we do with our body. Like, read about going to the bathroom. It's very precise. I would never make it, actually. Step to the left. If there's a senior in the room, step to the right. Use this. I mean, it's very particular. Why? Why? Washing the face, using the toilet, taking a bath, brushing our teeth. Maybe he's telling us his experience, what supports and sustains him. He's sharing this with us. He's saying, maybe, guess what? There's no thingness to anything, that its elements are vacant without any autonomous, self-existing nature. They're in relationship with everything else, and they're changing in each moment. And so we're going to look with such precision so we can see this, we can get this, that this is true. So we don't just brush by. So we study this miraculous display that we're entirely part of with meticulous care and attention, because it's so precious and unique in its ever-changing display. And of course, many of us read science and what physicists saying, that at the bottom of everything is just movement. That's what they see, particles moving, energy. It's a dance, that the ultimate is movement of energy. And we look at a mountain, we say, it's not moving. But you can see the mountain move a little. Look at it long enough, you'll see the mountain moving, walking. Dogen says it walks on water, has feet. It's this ocean that allows these little waves to come up. And we are these little waves. Waves come up and then go back into the ocean. And there's nothing left of that wave. Like a cloud in the sky, it's there, it's gone. We chanted this morning in the Heart Sutra, O Shariputra, all dharmas are forms of emptiness, not born, not destroyed, not stained, not pure, without loss, without gain. And Thich Nhat Hanh wrote on the Heart Sutra, it's not emptiness, it's fullness. I think it's interdependence, that's that quality where there's nothing separate. He is always saying, empty means empty of a separate self. So that's useful and helpful, especially in terms of our unique embodiments. So in the root of emptiness, shunyata, sunya refers to that looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. We have to be careful with that because we can just say it's nothing. But we have to remember this, each display is very important and worthy of our attention and our care. So we can't just brush it and say it's nothing. It looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. Just about everything we see looks like a lot, but it's really nothing. No own being, right? Back to what they're saying, not being separate. So we look at these set of dualities in the Heart Sutra, that there's 29 of them in the Heart Sutra. No, 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 I, you know, no ignorance, no end to ignorance, 29 of those. I didn't count, my friend did. I'm not a counter like that, but my friend likes to count, like in the faith mind, there's 36 sets of dualities, she told me. Okay. So, you know, it said the Heart Sutra was also a political document, and that's one part of it, of what this is saying, not stained, these two dualities, not stained, not pure. But we know for us that we have many ideas about what's stained and what's pure, what's right and what's wrong, don't we? How much suffering arises from this in our life? How much we cause others suffering because of our certainty about what's right and wrong, good and bad, pure and defiled in the retreat. This was a good drawing. This is a bad drawing. And I said in the beginning of the treat, Rumi's quote, which I love, which is, you know, there's this vast field beyond right and wrong, and that's where we're going to meet. There's a vast field beyond right and wrong. I'll meet you there, he says. So it's interesting to see what kind of confidence or lack of we breed in ourselves. We can be so demanding, so perceiving of ourselves as stained or defiled. So there's this monk from the 8th century I found, Chi Chung. He said, it's as if someone dreamt that the pearl of the moon was defiled by falling into muddy water. And they tried to wash it clean and then awoke and realized that the moon was not in the water and had never been defiled, and that washing it hadn't purified it, that it's always been pure. We can imagine that the moon has been defiled by falling into muddy water, and we can try to wash it clean. Not stained, not pure. Things are just as they are. That's the perspective from the Heart Sutra. Not stained, not pure, without loss, without gain. So Dogen's writing, these teachings of the Heart Sutra encourage us to not look away, but to practice in this most intimate bodily realm with precision. He points out in our own impermanent bodies, we face our deepest fears and aversions. We know this. Whole groups of people are still subject to hatred and atrocities and are killed based on our perceived unacceptable differences because of embodiment. What we don't see is there's no one to experience liberation or emptiness without interrelationships. This doesn't happen. It can't. We need to look at our embodiment in the face in order to attend to the challenge it presents. And only then will we come to engage each other with all of what we are. In taking our bath, washing our face, cleaning the bathroom, encountering the other. When will we see that this is our very body and mind? And caretaking takes us, I was going to say, right into the bowels of that, which is appropriate, the belly of that, to use our hands, practice using our loving hands, our loving eyes, our care for the house, the buildings and ground that support, that uphold, preparing a meal, to see everything as Dharma, supporting, sustaining, upholding, everything, everything, nothing left out. Where do we begin and end? Somebody was drawing a nose, and it was to be a continuous line, and just draw that, the nose, concentrate on one feature again and again, like see as much as you can in your nose. You should try this. And they couldn't find like where to start or end, like where does the nose begin and where does it end? So it was going all over, right? It was connected everywhere, this one little nose. It was great. And then we find out in caretaking what we will touch, what we won't touch, what we'll be touched by, as a surprise perhaps, how we care. We might dawn on us that leaving a heater running is leaving our heat running, leaving our fire burning unattended. Missing the corners of the bathroom is missing the corners of our mind, missing the corners of washing our toes. Why do we miss it? Why do we skip it? Why are we averted to going down there in that corner, not seeing it as part of the whole, taking care of it, not waiting the next person will get the corner? Why would we give our life away and not go to that corner and feel that preciousness of that moment that we have to clean the corner so well? And you feel it when it's your body and you do that little corner in the bathroom. It does a little corner in you that you haven't gotten to. It's amazing how it works. And there are two places I think that were more alike than different, and that's the sick bed and the toilet. I've been looking at the face, so. And I was thinking of Ru Jing, Dogen's teacher. At his own request, he asked to be head of the toilets when he was his monk. Today it would be nicely called the sanitation officer, but in those days it was called shoveling shit. We might still call it that. And Ru Jing was apparently a very humble monk. And I love his story about his insight into the Prajnaparamita. So he was in charge of all the shit, at the monastery, literally. And one day his teacher asked him, "Ruijing, how can something that has never been soiled be cleaned?" So if you think of your life, if I think of my life, think of your idea. I thought of my idea of shame. How can that which has never been soiled be cleaned? Ruijing did not respond immediately. He hung his head and went back and continued to shovel shit. For over a year, he practiced that single question all the time when he was sitting, when he was walking, when he was eating, when he was working. How can that which has never been soiled be cleaned? Everything he did, how can that which has never been soiled be cleaned? And one time he said, "I don't think I see this. I don't understand, Zhejiang." Zhejiang said, "If you just climb out of your old rut, you'll be free." You know, you can imagine this rut, you know, when you ride a bike in a rut, what it takes to, like, you can't do anything unless you, like, leap. You gotta, like, yank it out, or you're gonna just stay in there. It's hard. So he keeps making a rut. What's the rut? Pure, impure, good, bad, clean, dirty. As long as I'm in that rut, I won't be free. Dividing it up. One day, when he was back shoveling the shit out of the canals, suddenly, for whatever reason, he got it. And he raced to his teacher and he said, "I have finally hit upon that which is not soiled. I have finally hit upon that which is not soiled." He climbed out of his idea of purity and impurity, his ideas of a separate self, as himself separate from others, his ideas of good and bad. And he was free. He hit upon it. What is it that is not stained and not pure? Where is a single feeling, a single thought in the mirror image which I gaze? And it was great to see and witness and even find in myself, I work a different way as I'm leading it, because I'm also working on new things and trying things out. So it's not like I'm not in the retreat, but I'm working in the same way. And it was great to see the breakthroughs. And people didn't know it, but it was happening. And some actually did feel it. So I just grew to have amazing respect for Dogen and what he felt for hygiene and its power and practice. And it's fascinating reading it. Like, here's one line from Senjo, which is devoted to washing the body. He says, "At just the moment when we dignify body and mind with training, eternal original practice is completely and roundly realized. Thus, the body and mind of training manifests itself in the original state." And then the very next sentence, he refers to cutting one's fingernails. And it's like, wow, like what? So it's related in some way. You know, he's speaking about love. Somebody's like, where's the love in Zen? I never hear. He's talking about love here. He talked about detailed instructions on how to clean oneself after a bowel movement, how to cut your nails, shave your head, use a towel, brush your teeth, wash your face. Of course, some of it was just a necessary attitude to have people living in close quarters in harmony. Right, residents? For one who is in the toilet, he writes, this is so modern. Do not chat or joke with the person on the other side of the wall. This is Dogen. Do not chat or, now you think, why would he be writing this? Because he sits and chats and jokes with a person on the other side of the wall. It's not like he hasn't done it. But he's saying, like, this is what I'm seeing about this attitude. Do not chat or joke with the person on the other side of the wall. Do not sing songs or recite verses in a loud voice. Do not make a mess by weeping and dribbling, and do not be angry or hasty. Do not write characters on the walls. And do not draw lines in the earth with your shit stick. That's what they had for cleaning up. Now, I have not been a nurse. I haven't been a hospice practitioner, but I don't feel squeamish. At least I say this with not knowing, but at this point, I don't feel so squeamish about body and its fluids. I don't know why. Some of us might be very squeamish about this, but I feel very connected, and I move in close when people get hurt. Maybe it's because I've been a nosebleeder for a good chunk of my life, like for hours. So I've always had to deal, and you know, I'm a woman too, so there's a lot of bleeding going on. And seeing Jinfu here, I remember one time I got sick, and she said, "Oh, come in my room. I'll make you a bed. I'll take care of you." And I was just like, "Wow, nobody's ever been excited about having me in their room when I'm sick." I remembered that. It was just like I had a fever, and I was throwing up all the time. She's like, "Come in my room. I'll take care of you." And I was just like, "Okay, I'm on it." And I remember I was the cook, and I had such a high fever, and I dreamt I was dealing with the leftovers. Because when you're a cook, it permeates you for a while, right? And I was kind of new, and I was really sick, and in my dream, I was opening jars, and I was going, "Is that okay? You know, is it checking it?" And I physically, in her room, she had her paint around me. I started to open jars, and when I woke up and in the mirror, I had paint all down the front of my face because I was sticking my fingers in her paint jars, tasting if it was, isn't that great? I looked in the mirror, and I had white all down my mouth and my shirt. I was like, "Oof, this is bad." So she moved them away very quickly. But and I appreciate very much the privilege of being with someone dying. I've had a few opportunities to do that, and it feels natural to be there. And I didn't know I would feel that. And I don't know that I'll always feel this way. But in those times I've had, and many of us find it hard, and that's okay. We don't want to be near pain, near the death process, maybe not with a person, maybe with an animal or a tomato. Dealing with bodies, the juices that get sick and weak, and seeing all the fluids that are produced. We're pretty juicy, and then we're pretty dry. Of course, we try hard to hide this and maybe even say it's not going to happen or it's not happening. It's commodified to not have it show or even happen. Or it's made into entertainment and made as a spectacle that we sit back and watch it, all the goriness, all the juice, and we get a different kind of sensation there. Of course, we all have direct experiences with our bodies that do things. Leaking and smelling and giving way in all sorts of ways. And Nagarjuna said, "Change makes all things possible." That the only thing that is permanent, and it's because of change that suffering can end. It's because of change that suffering can end. All bodies fall apart like all compounded things. We can't have one without the other, but we try. We try to not see that's what's happening. And as practitioners of the Buddha's Dharma, what the Buddha offers us very directly in his teachings and his love as well, is to accept the impermanence and the inevitable decay of our physical bodies, a fact that we still may not want in plain sight. And when I was away, I changed my proxy, and I wanted to offer myself instead of just going to the incinerator. I wanted to allow the Sangha to sit with my body. So I will put that down. Whoever wants to be in that reality, I will offer that. And when I looked up the, fluids are also what intersperses with the world, are fluids. That's why we always say, use the sanitation stuff, because that's how much it disperses. And this word, I looked up effluvium. In Latin, it means, of course, flowing out. So can I manage flowing out without flinching? I remembered in a mime class, we had to find our partner by smell. That was a woe. I wasn't ready for that one, but I did it. I consented. I said, all right, and you gotta take it in, you know. We're blindfolded and you gotta sniff around for a while and then find your partner. It's very interesting to do, very edgy. He didn't do it the first day, of course. And Dogen brings us our attention to everyday fluid exchanges numerous times as great places of spiritual practice, as ceremony, as healing, as being alive, as one divided activity, to encounter the body with the body itself. This means deliberately looking at what we don't want to see, noticing what thoughts arise, noting our reactions, both physical and otherwise, and the opportunity once again to turn towards with curiosity and loving attention. If we can do it for ourselves, where it has to start, that's how we do it for others. Because in the end, there will probably be people that we have to go to that will take care of us if we get to that point. You know, Dogen liked to refer to people as skin bags, Dido too. Sometimes I used to be like, wow, skin bag. You know, it's a kind of like, ouch sometimes. Because he never tired of reminding us that we're fragile vessels. And he criticized those who didn't care about hygiene or reject the possibility of using the body as a vehicle for awakening. He criticized those who seek after purity, who want to skirt past the messy nature of being human in every realm. So an early ancestor, Kongshi Daoran, she was 29 on our list of women this morning, she wrote a poem on a bathhouse wall. She thought she was just too impure for practice, and she just said, you know what, I'm just going to do laundry. Let me just clean the bathhouse. It always happens this way, right? Let me just clean the cemetery. I can't do this. And she wrote on the bathhouse wall, if nothing truly exists, what are you bathing? Where could even the slightest bit of dust come from? Even if you see no difference between the water and the dirt, it all must be washed completely away when you enter here. Whoa. We are neither pure nor impure, not stained, not pure. Seeing past the false opposites. Brushing teeth, having a bowel movement are not actions that can lead us to purity. They are themselves purity. Complete in themselves. It's not enough to wash. We have to discover what it is to be naturally a pure form. He says, without washing the inside of emptiness, how can we realize cleanliness within and without? He said, Dogen writes, purity and impurity is blood dripping from a human being. At one time it's warm, at another time it's disgusting. The opening of the wound may be hard, but the flowing of the blood is very easy. He offers us to not be drawn into a life solely of mind or spirit, away from the reality of the body, but to be working always at a true and total presence in the self, here and now. The self, in his words, that is always flashing into existence. I like that. And one of the blessings of living with all of you in the Sangha for so long, some of you in residency, is seeing the changes in the bodies of one another. You know, I haven't been to New Zealand. I went just recently and I hadn't seen them in 2 years. And I was saying to Zuiko, I was like, oh my God, like little Keto is a guy. He's a man. It's like it changed so much in 2 years. And embracing them, those changes. We watch our friends and family grow old and wrinkled and stooped. This is a gift. It's a kind of nakedness. No. We watch our faces change and blur in the mirror. We're watching endless, endless change, and we're watching eternity in here, in this Dharma family, in our family families, and shoulder to shoulder with our fellow workers, or with our workers, side by side on the cushion, alone in a cave. No way out of the sense object we call the body. We meet each other face to face, just as have all our teachers and ancestors met each other. In this way, we have what all the Buddhas taught, blood, sweat, and tears together. And I'll end with this gifted poem on the subway, on one of those plaques. A strange, beautiful woman met me in the mirror the other night. Hey, I said, what are you doing here? She asked me the same thing.